All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fuck nicks? What the fuckaholics? What the fuckadelics? What the fucktuckians? I don't know why I'm specific about fucktucky. I got nothing specific other than I like saying it. What the fucktuckians? So they're special only because I enjoy saying what the fucktuckians. There's good people in Kentucky. There's good people all over. But there are some horrible people too. And some states have more than others, if you know what I'm getting at. Okay? Now, I'm not saying evil. I'm not saying, you know, stupid. I'm not saying, you know, like human garbage. I'm just saying horrible. And you know who they are and you know who you are. That being said, we are all trying to get through this time. How are you? Are you okay? Is everything all right? Did you get all that organizing done? Did you put that picture up? Did you figure out a way to get your kids to shut up for a few hours, an hour, 15 minutes? I talked to somebody the other day, today actually. I don't want to say who it is because it's an upcoming episode. I don't know when it's going to be on. But she brought up a fascinating thing, I thought. Her and her husband came up with an idea that I thought was a good idea. And I don't have children. They have like two or three children. And they were trying to figure out, how do we make this work, this indefinite quarantine? And none of them had seen Lost. So now there's like, what is there, 900 episodes of Lost? 1,007? How many? 1,010? 1,014? So they're actually watching an episode. None of them have seen it. So they're watching an episode a night. How fucking genius is that? I mean, how many, like, that's something the whole family could lock into and, you know, you can just ride it out. It's like, it's built in babysitting. I've never seen any of it. Grown-ups are doing TikTok. I don't even know what the fuck that is. But I mean, I draw the line at Twitter for stupid name shit. TikTok? Grown people are doing TikTok. So that means someone's going to say, do you know how to do TikTok? I'm like, I don't want to even know what it is. I don't want to know what it is. Because from my experience with this type of shit, once someone says, do you know what it is? Do you know how to do it? And I go, no. And someone says, you should check it out. It's probably a month to 6 months before I'm doing TikTok. Like, I'll fight the good fight for a while, and then I'll be like, look, I did a TikTok. And then I'll be in the race. Who's doing the best TikToks? You know, it's a matter of time. Whit Thomas is on the show. Whitmer Thomas, comedian, musician, actor. Worked with him on the film Sword of Trust. He played one of the sympathetic rednecks, the Lynn Shelton film. So look, you guys, I want to address something that I think upset a couple of people, at least three, right? At least three. I go through stuff, you know, with the shoulda, woulda, coulda, or just, you know, beating myself up or just getting, you know, anxious about everything and freaked out, you know, not just about the disease, about what happens when we get out. Am I going to do this? Am I going to do that? Like, you know, when my brain runs away with me, there's only a couple of things I can do. There's only a couple ways to wrangle it back in. You know, when I get into the future horror. And it's fairly dramatic self-talk that I engage in. Okay? To make myself feel better. There's, you know, and this is addressing what I said the other day. I'm done. I'm fucking done. It feels good to say that. I'm fucking done. Done with what exactly? Whatever it is that I think is causing me anxiety. Work, living in this country, eating, life, cats, etc. It really doesn't mean I'm done. It's just comforting to me. I'm working on some other ways to deal with it in the sort of acceptance realm. You know, like, hey man, you know, this is what it is right now. That feels okay. But like a few seconds later, I'm back to like, I'm fucking done with this shit. Fucking done with it. But that's better than I'm going to kill myself. I think we've made progress just by me saying I'm done in a general way with most things. But the point I'm trying to make to you is clearly I'm not done, is what I'm saying, okay? Because I got an email from a few concerned people. One guy's sort of like, you know, go fuck yourself if you're done. Just do it already. It's not going to matter to us. That was a nice email to get. But this woman, Julia, subject line, I'm done, in quotes. Hey, Mark, how funny it is to see the mantra of my last few days repeated by my favorite comedian, podcaster, going live on Instagrammer, actor, etc. You and I must have had the same epiphany at the same time about just being done. I'm done worrying. I'm done being anxious. I'm done spinning myself out. No, actually, Julia, it was quite different. I'm done with the things that cause those things to happen. Work, love, cats, life. You seem more together than me. And she writes, does it mean it actually does a full stop? No, not really. But it helps because it's like I'm holding a stop sign up at my brain and I'm just like, stop, done, no. That's good. That's proactive. I've noticed a slight drop in anxiety in the past couple of days as well. But whether that's just a cycle and it will be back in force in another couple of days remains to be seen. Hang in there, Mark. Thank you. Can't wait until this shit is over. Excited to see what we all look like. And oh my God, I'm excited to fucking hug someone. Jesus Christ, that has been the worst. Love you, Julia. Thank you. I'm not done. I'm not done, Julia. I'm staying. I'm staying in the saddle. I'm good. This one, I don't know if I can read it, but it's sort of, it's about Laura Linney's dad. She talked about him. Difficult person. So I guess I can read this. Subject line, Laura Linney's dad squashed my creative soul. Hi, Mark. Listening at this moment to the Laura Linney episode, I was in a graduate creative writing program at University of Pennsylvania in 1990, and Romulus Linney was the writer in residence. My workshop mates responded powerfully and positively to the opening chapter of a novel I was working on, but the acclaimed playwright tore it to shreds. The class was stunned, and I was crushed in real time. I dropped out of grad school for a lot of reasons. I still remember that feeling 30 years later. I struggled through lots of depression and OCD and addiction for years as a struggling writer until finally getting sober in 1998. And then I struggled with depression and OCD for a lot longer after getting sober, but that's another story. I'm coming up on 22 years of sobriety in a bit. Congratulations, pal. I've been reading my old manuscripts, unpublished novels and screenplays during the pandemic quarantine. Some of my old stuff is good. Some of it is bad. Most of it is both. Anyway, Laura sounds like an amazing person, and something about her description of her father soothed my 30-year-old artistic injury. For this moment, anyway. Go figure. I've emailed you before. I moved to Albuquerque 5 years ago, and I'm a psychoanalyst out here. Nice. Only mildly crushed that you never responded previously. Kidding, I think. Thanks for being a consistent, entertaining, thought-provoking voice in my head and earbuds. There you go, David. It's your day. David, it's your day. It's happening. David in Albuquerque, it's happening. I'm glad you landed on your feet after your hurt feelings. I hope that wasn't the straw, man. Heartbreak, man, never goes away. It just never goes away. It's just right there under the surface, and you don't got to scratch very far to feel that ache. Whitmer Thomas has an HBO special on currently called Whitmer Thomas, The Golden One. It's available on all HBO platforms. The songs from The Golden One are available to stream or download and as CDs and LPs with two exclusive tracks not featured on the special. It's a harrowing personal tale, an emotional tale that he talks about what he goes through in the show, but also what you're about to hear from my conversation with Whitmer. So this is me talking to him. He came in live. He braved it. We sat apart, took a picture apart, chatted apart, and it was a good talk. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years.
years ago.
Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. There's a kitchen.
Oh,
it's a completely permitted accessory dwelling unit. Someone could live in here comfortably if they can live in this much space, but legally.
I could do it.
Oh, sure. I think people we know could do it. Almost anyone could do it.
Yeah.
It'd be a relief.
I could live under the stairs.
Sure, man. I mean, it's like when I go to hotels now, I used to be weird on the road, but now I'm like, this is great. None of my shit is here.
Yeah.
It's clean.
I love it.
You do?
I love a hotel.
Yeah, man.
I love a hotel, a motel, whatever. I realized when I was like 26 that I had only stayed in one hotel.
Ever?
Yeah.
Like you'd never been away from home?
I've been away from home plenty of times, but we were so stupid as like punk kids. We would like sleep in a car or whatever it was. And,
yeah.
And then get a motel. Realizing as an adult that like now a motel only costs like $40 some places.
For a cheap one? Yeah, I guess so. For like a Comfort Inn or a La Quinta or something?
Yeah, but when we were kids on tour.
Yeah.
You know, that's $10 between the four of us, but instead we would
sleep in the car. Didn't you sleep at people's houses?
Yes, hopefully that was the hope, is like begging on stage.
Fans. Yeah, hey man.
Yeah, please.
Help us out.
Yeah.
And then you'd sleep on someone's basement floor with their parents upstairs, that kind of thing.
Shivering. Yeah, dude, that was the best if parents were upstairs and they'd make you breakfast in the morning.
So they were nice. Supportive parents.
Nice parents.
The good parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Even at this point, even like if I have friends who have the capability, like the money or the space to offer me, you know, come stay at our house. Mm-hmm. You know, you have your own bathroom. I'm like, no.
Same. I never want to do it.
I'm going to stay at the hotel. How far is the hotel from the event?
Nowadays, I'll get a hotel like right by the airport, too. And I'll just...
Oh, wow. Yeah. You don't want to have anything to do with that town.
No. And that way I can sleep as late as I possibly can before the flight.
Get out right under the wire?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't do airport hotels, unless I have to.
Well, I'm new. I'm new to all this hotel stuff.
Are you? Oh, to the touring thing?
Yeah.
I usually go to... I'll stay by the venue.
Yeah.
What does the venue recommend near the place?
Yeah, I've opened, you know, for comedians. Yeah. They really got it down packed where they, like, know all the questions to ask.
Right. And, you know, so you've opened for some dudes that take you with them and put you up?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's nice.
That's
yeah.
the best.
It is. And then, like, who have you opened for?
I opened for Bo, I opened for Dimitri and Rory and Todd Glass.
The nice fellas. So now let's talk about these guys because I know all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, somebody like Bo, I'm sure, like you guys get up and you eat and you hang out a little bit, right?
Yeah, yeah. But when I was opening for him, he couldn't talk because he was about to tape his special and he had lost his voice.
Oh, wow.
And so he was trying to keep his voice.
Mm.
And so we would go around town and like I would have to talk for him everywhere.
So. It's a little extra added opening.
Yeah.
Open for him at the restaurant.
Yeah. And then after the show, we would talk and hang out. But before the show, he's like, I'm sorry.
How many shows did you do with that guy?
Like 14, maybe.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And who was the other? Bo and Rory?
Yeah, Rory.
He'll eat with you, right?
Yeah, we hung out a lot.
Yeah. Dimitri, probably not so much.
Dimitri, no. We would just hang out in the green room.
That was it. See you later, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. No breakfast. No socializing.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I could see that. Yeah.
I had the best night of my life opening for him, though.
Oh, really?
I walked out of the casino and I put some money in a slot machine and I won $1,200.
$1,200?
Yeah. It was sick.
By yourself?
Yeah. Alone.
You got to yell and scream by yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Todd's got to be fun to open.
Todd is fucking wild, man. He, like, stays up all night talking to people.
Really?
Yeah. Just, like, whoever wants to talk to him. You'd hang out in the lobby I'd like come.
I don't know if that's wild or sad.
Yeah.
The fine line between like, man, that's kind of sad a little.
Yeah. Well, no, it seemed all right. I'd walk back to the hotel after like visiting friends of mine or something like that in the town, and he would just be sitting in the lobby like talking to
whoever. The hotel.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Oh, so he's just not necessarily people at the show, but whoever's around.
Yeah.
Just socializing.
Yeah.
Lonely guys socializing.
It was great.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
So I appreciate you coming during the plague.
Thanks for having me.
Well, yeah, but not many people willing to make the journey, even if I guarantee them a clean environment. I sprayed down that mic with some alcohol. That's not vinegar in that spray bottle. It's alcohol.
Cool.
And there's hand sanitizers available. I've got rubber gloves.
I haven't really been leaving. Other than to just do little, go to the store or whatever it is, but I'm really excited to get to do this. So I don't care if I get sick or whatever.
I don't want to get sick, but I don't think I'm gonna get you sick. We're on top of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna have to figure out how to open the door. Like the thing. The thing that's weird is that it's like it goes both ways. It's like I'm just as like I don't think I have it, but they make you kind of paranoid.
Yeah,
like, maybe I do. I don't know it.
Keep like sucking in to see if I can like hold air in my lungs good, you know.
Oh, that thing. Yeah. Well, I've been running. I went running yesterday.
Good.
You've been skating?
Yeah, I've been skating.
Yeah.
Can't run. Don't got any ligaments in my knees.
Really?
I would. I see these people running and I'm really jealous of it.
But you can skate?
Yeah, yeah. It's like I can choose to do one or the other, but apparently running is really bad for my knees.
Oh.
So I can skate and I don't have to use both of my knees in the same kind of way
because I'm
pushing, you know?
Right, one of them's just holding your foot on the board.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed a little bit of skating in the special, not much, a little bit, but it was like, oh, like one little thing that was fairly complicated. I'm like, oh, you know how to do that. Second nature kind of deal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can just do that.
Well,
Didn't you land on two boards or something?
Yeah, well, yeah, hey, that's cool you noticed that. You're the only person to say that, so that's
cool. What do you
mean? Well, I did land on two boards, and it was something that we sat there for a second trying to do, thinking it would be a bigger moment, and then, of course, it's like, why would that be a moment at all?
It was kind of quick.
Yeah, it was a quick moment.
So you and I, like, I guess I should preface that you and I were in sort of trust with me.
Yeah.
You played one of the redneck young men.
Yeah.
And but also, when we were shooting that in Alabama, you informed me that you were on GLOW, and I didn't realize that, but you were the fan of Gail Rankin.
Yeah.
The genius. And you Incredible. Showed up at the wrestling match dressed as her.
Yeah.
That was you.
Yeah, and so when I was on set, and we had met before that, years ago.
Right, but there was no way I was going to remember doing your horrible show.
No, so I didn't want to say hi because I looked like a fool. If there was ever a way that you did remember that, I'd have to force you to go through the Rolodex of like the specific things in that show to even maybe.
In power violence?
Yeah.
No, I remember that because I was sort of like, I did not like doing those kind of shows, and I don't know who talked me into it or who said it was a good thing to do. I just remember that it was overamped. There was something fucked up happening in there. Everybody was way too excited or too worked up. It was not a good environment for a comedy show. It should have been. And I just knew that there was no way I wasn't going to get up there and ruin the vibe and also be mad about it.
No, dude. But do you remember what you did?
No.
Okay, you just made, you were like, I can do this, like this kind of shit. And you were like doing bits that you thought that the audience was going to like, like making fun of them, but it killed. Like, and you went after Zach Galifianakis who did like his absurdist stuff. And so you were like doing your more absurdist ideas. You did something about a dolphin.
Oh, wow.
Or dolphins or something.
That's exciting.
It was really funny. It was great.
It worked out.
Yeah, and at the beginning of the show, we set our friend on fire. And so we were like, we didn't know what the hell we were doing. And looking back, it's like, I'd hate to have to follow someone getting set on fire.
It's the worst, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you're not really hosting as much as you are just like creating a place where you can do your crazy shit. And then like, oh yeah, here's a guy we asked to come do this.
Right, here's a guy who makes a living doing it. I keep thinking about like, why we got Zach Galifianakis and Mark Maron on the same show.
How did that happen?
10 years ago? Like,
I kind of remember standing in the back with Zach, like thinking, like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Why are we doing this still?
Yeah, and it was like Zach hadn't done comedy in years. And
he was trying to get out and get and
that
loose.
That was the first.
Oh, yeah? But was it, what was, the, it was called Power Violence, but what was the theme? What was, why was it, because all these shows back then, these produced shows, had to have some grabby angle, a lot of them did. What was it exactly? Because the title's kind of heavy.
Right. Power Violence was like a genre of music that we liked, me and my friends, which is like a grindcore, metalcore, blast beat.
Right.
So
is that the stuff out of Sweden?
Yeah, I mean, sort of like black metal. Yeah. Black metal, but less aesthetically.
Dark?
Dark, yeah. Oh, yeah. Just more like silly, I guess.
And, yeah.
So we called the show that, I don't know why, and we didn't know how to do comedy. The truth was that I started doing that show because I had gotten some money from my mom who died, and she was like, don't spend it on rent. So I was like, oh, I can rent a theater. That's different. Okay, yeah.
Right. She was more like, put this towards your dream.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Right.
So I rented that little black box, and then we started just like, we were already in a band.
Yeah.
Playing around town, and it was like...
What was the name of the band?
We were called Tooks.
Tooks?
Yeah.
T-O-O-K-S,
yeah. Mm. Which was like, it was during the kind of garage explosion, like in the 2007 era.
Who came out of that explosion, just to give me some context?
Ty Siegel and all those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were just miles cooler than us, and we were just idiots on stage and talked too much, and like, nobody liked us. We were annoying to everybody, and... Uh-huh. And so when we started that show, I had the band guys in the show with me, and then we would bring up stand-up comedians, because I didn't realize that stand-up comedians would just do any show.
You could get huge names to do anything in this town.
And then we'd sort of stop playing music and just would like fuck around and do whatever we could to get laughs, and then eventually kind of evolved into doing more of a focused show, stand-up show.
So, but previous to that, you didn't do comedy?
No, I took classes at UCB, and I wanted really badly to be a comedian. I would try every 4 months to do stand-up.
So the dream was music?
It was music for my whole childhood, and then I moved out here thinking I could get into acting and writing.
Huh. Well, let's go back, because I mean, I watched a special, it was called The Golden One? Golden One?
Yeah.
And it's pretty emotionally raw, and I'm like sort of a specialist of emotionally raw at times. But like there are moments there where it's like not particularly comfortably raw. Like there's moments during the special where I'm like, he doesn't really have a handle on this yet. He has no closure at all on this, and this is kind of hard to watch. But there are good parts, too. And I'm not saying that's a bad part. I'm just saying it's a slightly courageous, kind of insane part. What are you laughing at? Is it hurting you?
No, it's absolutely true.
It's like, you know, like, how did he pitch this?
Well, I don't know, man. I mean, yeah.
But I mean, the idea of sort of getting closure, you know, I mean, the thrust of the show is about your mom's death and then, you know, her being an entertainer and playing at this place as a regular performer and you going back to that place, sort of a full circle thing to your hometown. I guess that's what it is then. Then this was an exercise in getting that closure.
Yeah.
That, you know, like you don't have it, but maybe this will do it.
Right.
And I'll show everybody this painful attempt.
Yeah.
To display all of my talents in the rawest way possible in front of friends and family at this weird joint. Now, where is that place? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a place called Gulf Shores, Alabama. And the Floribama is, you know, it's like on an island in Alabama called Pleasure Island. And then the Floribama is right off of that island, still in a piece of Alabama called Perdido Key, on the line of Florida and Alabama.
Gulf Shore, Alabama is it's on the water.
Yeah.
And it's next to Florida. It's like that corner there.
Yeah.
Like, what's the closest town in Florida?
Pensacola.
Oh.
Yeah.
So this is like, you know, this is an observation I had, you know, watching it was, you know, a lot of Florida is the South.
Yeah.
you know, most of it,
mm-hmm.
probably. And but there's this moment where I realized when you were performing at this place and I saw some of the people in the audience, that if you don't come from the South, you know, you just assume that, you know, all the people that look a certain way act a certain way. And but you're definitely not of that ilk, and you're a sensitive guy who kind of went the way of sort of emo and goth and were different and a slightly fragile sort. And when I watch you performing in this environment, there's part of me that's sort of like, you know, man, that's got to suck. but then I realize, like, but you're from there and they know you. It like they whatever they're going to judge you as is you're the overriding thing is that you're still one of their own.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, man. It was like I was freaked out by that because that, you know, like I wanted to make sure that the because I'm like an L.A., New York kind of comedian. I love doing shows out here and I'm super progressive and all the shit I like has nothing to do with the South. And so going home, I was like, God damn it, I got to do it here. Like these people.
You didn't have to.
Well, I didn't have. Well,
but that was the pitch?
That was kind of the idea. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I went around, like I went to Birmingham and other places to test out to make sure that it would work
uh-huh.
and found that they liked it more than a lot of the shit they liked more than people in LA and New York.
I think
cool
a lot
places.
Of times they're sort of excited to see professionals.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. Yeah.
You know, like certain rooms that, you know, kind of get the rotation of the local cats,
mm-hmm.
you know, it, just to see if somebody's got some chops.
Yeah.
It's good. But I realize though, I understand that, but you are still genetically and emotionally from that place. Right.
Right. Yeah.
And in what you were talking about in the special about being the kind of kid you were, like, you know, emo, goth, what, you know, just arty kid, you were doing that there. So all those fucking rednecks or whoever, you still had to go to school with them and they had to deal with you and you dealt with them and they dealt with you and that happens everywhere.
Yeah.
So like, you know, there's this, you weren't an outsider. There's this idea that anybody that goes to the South, if they're not from the South, is an outsider. And that I think is kind of true. But you aren't, even though you're a weirdo.
Yeah.
The South has plenty of weirdos.
Totally. Like, and even more weirdos because they don't have the access in the same way that the big cities do. So, like, they get the half version of something, the, like, half-evolved version of the cool band or, like, the band that doesn't look as in the way that they're supposed to look.
Right.
So they become even stranger than the weirdos in the big city.
Right, because they're trying to do something. It's almost like they're... you know, the blob.
Right. Yeah. 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 Totally.
The blob kind of makes a weird kind of creepy facsimile of the person it absorbs.
Yeah, man. So like when I was in my bands, like we never got access. This is something I always noticed is like we never had access in the South to the pants of the time.
Come on.
So like there would be guys wearing like skinny jeans or whatever it
right.
was, but we didn't have skinny jeans. So we would still be wearing like these chunky looking whatever pants.
Levi 505.
Yeah, Levi 505s.
Yeah.
But with the rest, the top half looked the right way.
Right.
But the bottom half, we looked like fools.
Right. You didn't match the...
No.
Well, I mean, that was the thing, though. I mean, that was sort of... Like, I didn't really... But that was always a thing, even in the original wave of punks. You know, they had to get the record sent to them. Some cat, you know, who owned a record store had to fucking be the channel to get the shit.
Yeah.
You had to get people to send you the clothes from New York. Someone had to bring them down
right.
there.
Right.
But the skinny jean things, I thought most guys resolved by buying girl ones.
Right, that's what I would do.
Right.
I'd go to Target and get girl pants.
Yeah, the stretchy store. Pants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
And then, yeah, I mean, I just watched, like, a bad documentary on The Replacements, you know, and just
yeah.
how that weird theme of local bands, you know, having, like, there's the cover band, there's the ones that are the rock band, but then there's the art rock people that, and they're always going to be dressing in dresses and doing weird shit, but it's almost like a staple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it repeats itself over generations in one form or another. There's always going to be that band.
Yeah.
And you were them?
I'd say we were playing with them. We weren't them necessarily.
Oh.
We were pretty okay. We were fine. We didn't seem to ever fit completely in with anybody, but it was also when we would go out of town, when we would go to Nashville or somewhere cool
yeah.
to play a show,
right.
then we would become that band. But in our scene, we were okay. It was just like But also in our scene, there was not enough bands to even make like a proper scene.
In Gulf Shore?
Yeah, in Gulf. Well, Pensacola is like where we would end up playing. That was like really our scene.
I have no sense of Pensacola. I have no sense of what that's like.
It's like...
I mean, I've been to Tallahassee.
It's similar to Tallahassee, except it's on the water.
Uh-huh. Oh, so there's more of that beach Yahoo shit.
Yeah.
Like, even your brother, like there's a moment there where you're seeing your family and your cousin, you know, in these documentary moments. Where, you know, they're, you know, when you're talking to your cousin, you know, about your mom's death, you know, like he looks like a fucking Southern bro.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden he's just like all soft and breaking down. And
well, yeah, man, he stayed home. Yeah. We all left. My brother lives on a school bus and drives around with his family. My other cousin lives in, Denver. He like stayed there. So he's really dealing with all of the family hell, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, your brother, like, there's a moment where you're like, what's this guy about? And you're like, of course he's just a good guy.
Yeah.
Kind of like free spirit dude.
Yeah.
Can still play some guitar.
Big time.
Yeah. But like, what is the story? So he's your older brother and there's just two of you?
Yeah, he's my older brother from a different dad.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So his dad and my mom were, you know, successful drug smugglers, I guess is the story.
Uh-huh.
And then his dad went to prison. And then when my mom met my dad, they had me and 5-6 years later. And yeah.
But your mom has a twin sister.
Yeah.
And they were music act.
Yeah. Sin Twister. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, just the sort of talk of like, you know, if you grew up in the world of like music in a local scene or art in a local scene, this story is familiar, you know, like we almost had a record deal. Why didn't we record it? Like, you know, there was a time where we were kind of hot.
Yeah.
And you kind of focus a lot on that.
I do, man. They came close and more closer than I thought when I went back home, you know, talking to my aunt, like.
Oh yeah, about the record deal, the Virgin record deal.
Yeah,
but like, okay, so they're doing this act after the drug dealing husband goes to jail. She marries your dad, who's kind of like, you know, that he's come back into your life, and you get to see that guy. He doesn't quite fit in with it all. He must have really turned his life around somehow.
Oh yeah,
like, you know, like he's like, I don't know, it's just almost, he's a sober guy.
Yeah,
but so your mom. And he were married for how long?
Nine or 10 years.
So they really wrote it out.
Yeah.
But was it like, cause your mom was a drinking and drug addicted person.
Yeah.
But so, she somehow managed.
She sort of managed. It like fell apart when I was about 8. My dad jokingly said the other day that I had about 6 good years.
But oh, like, really?
Yeah. It really was. She didn't manage. No, I mean, maybe until I was 8 or 9, it was like, that's when everything, and with my dad too, that's where everything kind of really started to visibly be like, if there's like wine bottles in the house, I have to break them.
Like it was chaos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but like, was that during the time where she was her sister fucked up too?
Yeah.
Everyone was fucked up.
Yeah, her sister got sober first.
Oh, so did the getting out of control coincide with the musical dream sort of fading, or
no, really the first, there was a lot of hiccups. Like they were most promise was in the late 70s.
And your uncle was playing bass or guitar?
Oh, my uncle.
No, who was in the band?
Oh, that guy, Ricky Whitley?
Yeah.
He's not my uncle. He's just some swamp man.
Oh, really?
Who was always sort of in the band. Now he lives on a swamp. He's like completely, probably doesn't know Corona is happening right now.
Yeah.
But I just got him back there to play the show with me.
You went and found him?
Well, he sent me that VHS tape of my mom and him and playing. So that was sort of what kicked all this off. It was like that video.
Oh, the swamp man.
Yeah.
So there, like, see, that's something that a lot of us don't know what you're talking about. Swamp people.
Right.
There's swamp people in Alabama?
Oh, yeah, man. There's swamp people, dude, for sure.
What, and do they live, like, is the swamp, like, is there, like, a road where you're like, well, you would take that road, and then you're...
You want to go see some swamp houses? Some True Detective shit? Like, let's go, man.
That's where they are?
Yeah.
And they go, and then they're in New Orleans too, or in Louisiana coast.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Probably, but it has to have some density. So the, you know, foliage density to be swampy, right?
Yeah. And that we have all that where I'm from. It's like every type of, you know, body of water you could ever dream of.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. People who you can tell the type of person they are just by, like, oh, he's wearing those rubber boots. So
yeah.
He's like a swamp guy.
Okay, so the swamp guy sent you the video. Well, that was nice. Out of nowhere?
Yeah.
Huh.
Out of nowhere.
I wonder what that was about.
I don't know. He just sent it to me. He found it and he felt compelled to send it to me.
Is that the only existing video?
That I have, yeah.
That exists, yeah.
That I know of. I'm sure there's other ones. Mm. Well, we used to have a lot of tapes, but Hurricane Katrina kind of wiped a lot of them away.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's so wild. And that was the one that kind of triggered it. Okay, so what are the hiccups?
The hiccups are, they had a lot of promise. They were in Jamaica. In the 70s, living in Jamaica, playing, meeting every famous, you know, David Bowie, Bob Marley, all the people.
Keith Richards maybe was down there?
I'm sure. Whoever came down there, they were the girls who would go sing back up and just fun to hang out with.
White girls living in Jamaica who sang.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
And they were identical twins, and they were beautiful and just loved the party.
So some pretty big rock acts have some pretty serious memories.
Totally.
Of you.
Dude.
Do you remember the twins? Do I remember the twins?
Well, that's when I realized going home. It's all of these innocent stories that I would hear. Like, oh yeah, my mom would always tell me I spent the night with David Bowie, you know, and I remember as a kid thinking, she spent the night walking on the beach with David Bowie.
That's nice.
Talking.
They had a sleepover.
Yeah. And now I'm like, oh, damn it. David Bowie is fucking my mom.
There are worse things, dude.
Yeah, totally. so that was happening. And then my mom met her husband, my brother's dad. And then they got into smuggling drugs back and forth from Jamaica.
Yeah. Weed?
Yeah. So then he got caught. That was that became the focus. And they had a kid who died in a car accident too at that time. So it just was bad thing.
Oh, that's the thing it's not, I don't think you really delineate that stuff in the special, in the documentary. You talk to your aunt about the kid your mom lost, but I guess it was your brother, your half brother anyways.
Yeah.
But it happened long before you.
Right, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, so he died. Her husband got arrested. That was a big hiccup in the music thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then before he went into prison, they had my brother. When he went to prison, my mom moved back to Alabama.
Yeah.
Where my aunt had already moved back.
Yeah.
Then they had the second wind of Sin Twister.
Okay.
Let's focus. Let's record all these songs. They recorded so many good songs in this great studio called Airwave Studio in Birmingham. And so that was the moment for them, they might actually do it this time.
Was it mid-80s?
Mid-80s.
Yeah.
And then it just didn't really happen again. And then this reminds me of your monologue in Sort of Trust.
Yeah.
Then my aunt moved down to Gulf Shores a few years. Then my dad left. Mom followed. To Gulf Shores. And
where were you guys?
We were in Birmingham until I was a little kid, just until I was
really
seven,
right
or eight.
Where we shot that shit.
Yeah.
You lived there. So, but the scene at home though, yelling and screaming and throwing shit and
No, it was just mystery constant. I don't know who's gonna come home. I was luckily had an older brother who was there, you know. It was just, there was no classic movie drunkenness. It was nodding out, kind of fucked up. My mom's an ex-junkie, or she was a junkie until she died, I guess.
What, doing the dope?
Yeah, so it wasn't a...
Right. So it was more, is she alive? Go,
totally.
Shake her.
It was if she stops drinking, she'll have a seizure, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as energetic as...
Right. There's no Sid and Nancy shit going on. Dad looks like kind of a control freak dude.
Well, yes. And my dad was until 10 years ago, was this backwards hat, kind of cut off jean shorts guy.
Oh, really?
And then he met his wife, and they've very much, you know, now he's obsessed with fitness and kind of like yoga.
Golf.
And golf being.
But he's a sober dude, like, you know, real deal, does the thing,
does
sober
it,
guy.
Fully does it, runs meetings and all that
right,
stuff.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was sort of wild that, like, you know, because a lot of the jokes in the show, you know, were, you know, you're kind of, you're slightly dark jokes. Some of them were about the family, but it was more the songs, a lot of them, and some of the interstitial stuff that really kind of told the story of where you come from, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what, you didn't end up having a fucking drinking problem?
No. No,
your brother either?
No, we were like, my brother was, he got five more good years than I did. So yeah. We both had like a lot of hate in us. Like for alcohol and
right,
drugs.
Right. Yeah, that's the other way to go.
We just like, I was this kid who just fucking hated it and like hated it and felt completely uncomfortable and pissed off anytime. Like every time, you know, turning 13 when I'd see like my friends were starting to get fucked up.
Yeah.
Just like fucking pissed, but trying to be cool about it and saying I didn't care.
Right.
And that lasted until I was in my mid 20s probably.
Just right.
This like rage about it. And then my brother was a little bit more chill, but a really similar kind of,
oh, really?
Kind of way. Yeah.
What's the timeline on, like, because she died not that long ago, right?
She died 11 years ago.
Oh, it's 11 years ago? Already?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was 19 or 20.
And you were still at home?
No, I had just moved to L.A.
Okay, so your dad leaves,
mm-hmm.
and you're how old?
I was 9.
Oh, so
when
you had,
officially left when I was
so 9. You had, like, 10 years just being down there with your mother?
Well, yeah. So then my dad came back when I was in high school. When my dad left, my mom was in and out of rehab or in jail. She would get in trouble and be like what's it called? Where you can't
probation.
Leave. Probation, yeah.
So it's a real fucking mess.
Yeah. And then my dad had gotten sober. He was living, you know, in a halfway house and doing all that and kind of that life. He'd lost his law license and was...
He was a lawyer?
Yeah. And he came back to live in Alabama after visiting one time and, like, seeing the kind of shit show.
Squalor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
he stepped up?
He for sure stepped up. Yeah, it was really weird. He had kind of realized, like, wow, you know, Johnny and Whit kind of have already figured this out, how to raise themselves, so I'll like give them a place to stay and live and take care of them and work, you know. He worked as an assistant at a title company and just figure out how to help them in whatever way I can, but they've got it. So it was still like we didn't have any real rules or anything, but now we had like a consistent place.
Yeah, and you had your dad for whatever that was worth.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's always been like, dude, anytime, I'd love to talk to you and tell you what happened and what went down. And I waited until just recently for him to tell me. So
before the special?
Yeah, we sort of like, about 2 years ago, he was driving me to the airport and he like kind of laid it all out.
Yeah?
Just his whole fucked up shit.
Was it surprising?
No, I mean, once you hear it from him, he was like, I didn't expect to live this long. That was his idea. He was like, the shit I grew up liking was all these people, this free love. And then my age, for some reason, everything is synthetic. And like there was no more just people smoking weed and having sex with each other. It was like shooting heroin and getting AIDS. And like, it was a different thing, but my parents never hugged me and I just wanted to die. You know what I mean? So he was like, I wanted to live fast and leave a good looking corpse. And
right.
Then I had a family. And like,
yeah.
So I don't think it's a good thing, but I guess I get it. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like the one thing I noticed about the whole thing, so we'll get to it. So you, but by the time you leave to come out here, I mean, your mother's kind of lost to you anyways.
Yeah. No, I watched my mom die like 100 times. So it was, when she actually did die, it was really hard and painful, but it was sometimes, in a way, it was like a relief, as
right.
terrible as that sounds.
Yeah.
It's like she's actually gone. Yeah.
And when did, because another part of the sort of story is that, from the special, is that like your aunt, then your mom's twin sister, stopped talking to you?
Yeah.
For no...
No, I mean, all kinds of reasons. When my mom was dying, it was absolute chaos with, there was like drugs and money stuff and a safe with like a ring in it and all kinds of shit like that. And my aunt really was like going through hell dealing with her sister dying. Yeah. And then, she was doing some fucked up stuff, some bad stuff too. Uh-huh. Me and my brother who were watching our mom die. And, ultimately, like, I went to the funeral and, I was like, I'm never going to talk to any of these people again.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was a bad
brought
bad
out
scene.
The worst in everybody.
Yeah, everybody. I went to the funeral and they didn't they had decided that they didn't really want anything to do with me a long time before that, I think because I moved in with my dad.
Yeah.
So
there's just like this strain.
Yeah, when at the funeral they had a slideshow of my mom and her first son Casey and like their life together. Yeah, and then a slideshow of my mom and my brother, and then they didn't have anything of me.
Really?
Yeah. And so I was like, fucking, I'm out of here. This is it. And I left, like, just bailed, went back to California and never looked back.
So who called you to tell you your mom died? Your dad?
My brother. Well, he said, we need to go home. You need to come home. Your mom has got a couple more days. And she was keeping it a secret that she was dying.
What was she dying of?
Cirrhosis and Hep C and all the things.
All the things that life.
Yeah.
The gifts of that life.
Yeah, the gifts.
Yeah. The satanic souvenirs.
Right.
Of a life embracing hell.
And it's like, dude, and at that time, every one of my friends down there too, like each one of our parents were just...
Dropping
in the same kind of way.
Really?
Drugs or alcohol, yeah. Whatever. It's just like a hard living kind of place down there.
Oh. So when you came out here, it seems like, it's not that, specific, but it seems like, before she died or whatever was going down there, you just needed to get out of there.
Yeah, man. There was no way I was going to stay down there.
And you didn't, you had a vague sense of being an actor or being
a musician?
I met
a guy. I had stopped doing music because I had taken it so seriously throughout my whole childhood and never had like a life outside of a band.
Yeah.
And so I'd stopped doing it and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I had met my friend and co-director, Clay, who I grew up with down there. He had gotten a scholarship into Savannah College of Art and Design for a short little sketch thing we had made.
I hear that's a good school.
Yeah, it's a great school. And then I was like, well, maybe I could do something like that, but I couldn't go to some fancy school. And then I met a guy in Florida who worked at a special effects company in LA. And I was talking to him about it, like, maybe I can move to LA. And he was like, dude, give me a call when you I'll hook you up with a job as a PA. So I was like, great, that's what I'm doing. And that became my plan. And then moved out here right after high school, and that guy never answered the phone. It was like the rudest awakening immediately.
I've heard so many stories of the people that all it took is one guy. And they don't know the guy that well, but they're like, I'm going. This one guy who I don't know.
Didn't know him at all.
Yeah. Said, come on out and I'll set you up.
Yeah, man. And I wonder how many times I've done that to people now. Like,
I try to only offer things that I can handle, that I can really do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, all right, so you come out here, but that kid that co-directed the special with you, Clay, is his name?
Yeah.
And he was part of Power Violence as well?
Yeah.
So you guys have been working together for a long time.
Yeah, since we were 10, really. 10? He was in every band with me, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he's out here?
Yeah.
What's he doing?
He's just making stuff, writing, directing little things. You know, me and him are hopefully going to make more stuff, if they let us.
Sounds like you should make a real script about the family.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to. I'm trying. That's what we're trying right now.
Gothic.
If anybody's listening.
Indie movie.
Yeah.
Because I think that what's really compelling about it, drugs and whatnot, but and family tension, but it all sort of focuses around a very specific period in music. Where, they were kind of doing a Stevie Nicks trip.
Yeah.
Like a dual Stevie Nicks trip.
Yeah, they love, I mean, and I found all those tapes. Like, yeah. There's at one point when my aunt is talking about Casey, like we're at the kitchen and we're looking
about
through,
the kid that died?
Yeah. Yeah. 2-inch tape.
There's that big analog leaflet. Tape. Yeah. Yeah.
And she was saying those were all ruined by Katrina, and I got them all digitized, and the guy was like, these are 2-inch tape. You can't ruin these. Like, yeah. They're indestructible. So I was listening through shit all the way back to like 75.
You have it digitized?
I have all of it, yeah. Uh-huh. And I'm getting a bunch of the songs remixed and mastered because it's like some of them are isolated recording tracks.
Yeah.
But there's like recordings of them fucking around in a bar in Aspen doing like a cover of whatever Fleetwood Mac song.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really cool. And then you can hear them talking to each other in between songs and like entertaining the crowd.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That must be nice.
It's really cool. Yeah.
Well, that was sort of the interesting thing about, you know, retrieving this past. But okay, but we can get back around to that. So how did you land out here? What the fuck? What'd you end up doing?
I got a job at a skate shop in Santa Monica, Active Skate Shop on the 3rd Street Promenade.
And you're a good skater.
I'm okay, not by California standards. Right. In Alabama standards, I'm good because the ground isn't even good enough to push around on. But yeah. Once you get out here, it's like there's real good skaters.
Yeah, but you can hold your own.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was
enough
doing
to
that.
Be at a shop.
Yeah, enough to be the guy behind the counter at the skate shop.
But also probably the non-intimidating guy.
Yeah, especially back then, I'd be like, hey guys, y'all wanna?
Yeah, yeah, so. But they're kids, right? And the last thing they need is some alpha skateboard jock.
Totally.
You know, you're just like, you could do a few tricks and you're probably the ones that, you sell more skateboards to like 8-year-olds than anybody.
Totally, they really connect with me. Nobody has ever been intimidated by me in their whole life. So yeah, I was just doing that and then I looked up on MySpace.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, looked up people. I was like, is anybody out here from the South trying to be an actor? And then some people were like, oh, yeah, I'm from wherever, and here's what you got to do. And I went to an acting class, and then I was like, what else do I need to do? And then they were
which
like,
which acting class?
Some like scam studio.
Oh, really?
I'm sure it's some type of pyramid scheme. And they were like, you need to get a headshot. And I remember not knowing what headshot was and saying, what is a headshot?
Oh, wow.
And so they, you know.
It was a scam studio?
You know, one of those things where they're like, we'll introduce you to an agent.
Oh, right. Well, like, don't they all do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So how'd that work? Did you do some acting lessons?
I did all of it.
Okay.
And then I got into like real serious stuff, you know, and took it really seriously. It was like, growing up, like loved movies and Gus Van Sant and shit like that. And My Own Private Idaho is probably my favorite movie still, but especially back then. And I realized that like everybody out here who was working in all these acting classes on shows like Gossip Girl or whatever it was, they had like never seen a movie in their life. They were just like really good looking and people cast them and stuff. And I just became super bitter about it.
Oh yeah, prematurely bitter.
Yeah.
Okay. And without even getting into the game.
No, not at all.
I'm fucked. Look at these idiots.
I'm doing it. I'm trying really hard, and these people are actually doing it, and they don't know anything about it or care about it. And so that, luckily, like that shifted into me doing, you know, I was doing the band, but then I started doing stand up and stuff.
Yeah. So were you doing the stand up?
I started just like in all the alt rooms,
right?
And still, yeah, pretty much just like East Side rooms, you know. Like,
yeah.
We did some shows together.
Sure.
Hope,
I know.
You missed. I remember one time thinking, okay, I have a joke that I think Mark might like. And then you walked out right when I got on stage.
I'm sorry, dude. Where was that?
It wasn't Meltdown, but it was at Meltdown.
Oh, right. Like Andy Kindler's show or something?
Something
or
like that, yeah. You were with your niece, I think?
Oh, when Eden was in town. That one time. Oh, yeah. Got her in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, she didn't seem to care much. Yeah, I didn't know if I could keep her there. Like, I took off, huh?
Well, no, I mean, I was like, oh, you were sitting in the crowd, which was kind of, like, odd.
Yeah.
And then you stood up and left right after whatever. And
oh,
I was like,
sorry, buddy. I like to sit in the crowd sometimes. I'll sit in the crowd when my opener's on at a theater or something.
That's cool.
Get the feel.
Yeah.
What are people experiencing?
Yeah.
How does this feel for the people?
Yeah, that's good.
So, were you making a living doing comedy?
No. I didn't make a living doing comedy until 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Dude, the brokest of anybody I've ever known until like 3 months ago. I was like, me and my buddy Clay were always like, dude, how do people live?
Yeah.
Because for me, it's like unemployment and some crazy job or right. whatever, you know? Yeah, no, it wasn't until recent that I...
Yeah, it's because it is sort of interesting, like, you know, because watching the thing, the special, because I remember I saw like a trailer for it or something, but then I watched the special and I'm like, man, it's like he can't decide what he wants to do. And we're all watching the confusion. He's pretty good at a lot of things, but he's not willing to let anything go. And he's protecting himself from failing at any one thing by doing many things pretty well.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I don't know if I would put that on the blurb.
No, yeah, well.
No, but the thing is, like, I related to it. I'm not trying to be negative. I understand putting stuff out in the world that in retrospect was really probably too raw for me to know, you know, how it would land.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, it comes from complete desperation, like, for me.
Does it?
For me, yeah.
Desperation for what, though?
Anything. Like, it was desperate to connect again.
Right,
with
connect.
My...
Okay, that's different. That's different than, but that's not desperation for money.
Oh, you know, yeah,
it's,
no.
It's a desperation that, you know, can come through in creativity where, you know, you need to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
By whoever, you know, like, you know, this is me.
Right. I mean, it's some, in a way, desperate to be seen. But like, for me, it was like getting that tape. Like my comedy agents had just fired me right before that guy Ricky Whitley sent me that tape. And I was like,
really?
Yeah. The absolute, like.
They fired you because they couldn't get you work or?
Yeah. I was doing the Golden One show, but there was no music in it yet. And,
oh.
And people just kind of.
So it started as a one person show kind of deal.
Yeah.
About the death of your mom and.
Sort of, yeah. Uh-huh, less about the parallels of our failures.
Right. Oh, right. Oh, okay. And, yeah. That theme, the sort of like we both were failing. I mean, the thing was like, you know, you're young.
Right, but she was young too. Like, and so I kept when she was kind of, I kept thinking, oh, in that video, she's my age.
Right.
And she had already, it had already all happened, and now she's at this bar.
She's the house band.
Yeah, she's kind of done now.
Right.
And I kept going. I've just been like let go, and is this what am I gonna fucking do?
Right.
And she called me the fucking Golden One.
Yeah.
And like all the time, and. So, yeah, so that's kind of how that worked. And then I had recorded a bunch of music. I was like, maybe if I record all these songs that I wrote about, you know, my mom or whatever it is, breakups, I'll feel this connection and this, like, creativity. And so I recorded all these demos with a friend of mine, and then I listened back to all these lyrics, and I was like, this is fucking embarrassing. I'm never going to show anybody these songs.
And you showed everybody.
Well, I just changed all the lyrics kind of to make them more embarrassing.
Oh, okay.
Just removing metaphor.
Oh, to make them funnier?
Yeah.
Right.
Just like if I had a song about my mom drinking herself to death, just saying... My mom drank herself to death.
Right.
Instead
or I partied till I died.
What's yeah, yeah. It? Partied yeah. to death.
Partied to death.
Which was one of my first jokes, like saying my mom partied to death. And like, so, yeah, man, it was just like, it was just all out of this like fluster of like desperation to just like connect creatively.
Put this thing together, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was good. It was just like, because I'm sort of... sensitive to my own discomfort around performing uncomfortable things because I've always done it.
Yeah.
It's always been the way I start. You know, like I'm going to put this out there. And I know people are laughing because they're uncomfortable. They're not laughing because like I have complete control of this joke. You know, they're laughing because sort of like, oh man.
Yeah.
What the, you know, and that's a type of laughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it seems to me that, you know, doing the songs and telling the jokes, you know, around this stuff. I don't know why, was there a discussion about putting the song about having a hard time getting a boner? Was there, like, were you like, do I put this in? Is this really necessary?
I just feel like it's nice to have a break from the death to talk about erectile dysfunction.
Yeah, like, hey, let's lighten things up a little bit.
Yeah. Nobody's talking about it.
Not enough people are talking. Not enough people are being honest about it.
Well, sometimes there's like there's a certain type of person, guy, who will come up to me and I'm like, oh, this person lost his mom to alcohol.
Right.
And then there's a type of guy who's like, he's going to come talk to me. I felt like he can't get a boner.
Look, I mean, back when I was younger, I understood the performance anxiety part of it. But like, you just have to, are you getting better with that?
Yeah.
You just have to shift and say what you want and find someone who's patient.
Right. Patience, confidence, patience.
Yeah. Yeah. Just sort of like, you know, shut up. It's happening. stay with me. But it seems to me that most of the, closure that you got was really, it really seemed in the conversations with your cousin and your aunt was like really where the shit landed. Cause you, like, for some reason throughout a lot of that documentary footage, you didn't really, like, I could feel you not being able to get to your emotions around it. What you would lock down, like with your old man and shit.
Yeah.
You're locked down. I mean, you're social and you can be funny, but you know, you couldn't let go.
No, and it's just, and you know, I'm in therapy and all that stuff. It's just been such a part of my life forever. And I don't know necessarily how to access my anger and
what
that
the death?
Stuff over, no, just like my being fucked, you know, like in my childhood and my dad bailing, my mom, nobody taking care of me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know how to access the anger about it at all.
Mm.
So, talking to them, you know, the things that I get emotional about are usually not even involving them. It's like, so yeah, I didn't emote in the way that I wanted to, but then there is also more, I didn't also want it to feel like the apology tour, you know, of me like going around and talking to those everybody and trying to get them to say I'm sorry or whatever.
I didn't feel that at all. What I felt was was your cousin's empathy, you know, clearly, you know, there's this backstory about, you know, them all turning on you, you know, and then, you know, you coming back and doing this, that there was a real moment there where, you know, he seemed to feel bad.
Yeah.
And that moment was pretty, pretty amazing, right?
Yeah. He feels a lot of guilt. He was there for me when my mom was dying. The cousins were there, him and my other cousins and my brother. But he feels a lot of guilt about my childhood and not being there.
Mm.
You know, my brother and him and my cousin, my other cousin Jenny, they all had a car and could drive away, and just kind of often I was stuck. And my cousin Wilkes feels a lot of, all do. And that was that's a conversation we've since had together, the four of us. But it's like a—
What, leaving you?
They feel bad, like leaving me just kind of as a kid.
Yeah.
There to kind of break the bottles or whatever it is,
right?
When they could drive off and go fuck around.
Party.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You're dealing with the sad part of partying,
yeah.
And they're gonna go have a good time.
They're gonna go have sex.
Yeah, but when you regroup with your aunt, like, you know, how was that? I mean, she seemed a little withholding.
Yeah,
but
she was,
but willing,
and she's become less withholding now. It's like personal for her to, she was very willing and happy to talk to me.
And right. And that whole moment of you seeing your mom and her, because they're twins.
Yeah. Yeah. And I realized kind of, it's just, you get older and I just can't remember sometimes why I'm so angry. You know?
Right.
And I think she might not be able to articulate it, but she feels a lot of guilt and— about how everything went down. And, you know, she's still dealing with it. She says she dreams about my mom every night, you know?
Right.
That was her entire identity, was my mom. Like, her and my mom together.
Well, yeah, twins, it's rough, man.
Yeah. Especially when you're, like, creative together.
And they're identical?
Yeah. And so, I started to have a lot of sympathy for her.
And she's sober, too?
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about your old man, is like, you know, he seems, you know, legitimately kind of like, you know, born again, sober dude. Like, not, I mean, like born again, like sober, not Christian or anything. And like, you know, he knows how to do the work and process the shit.
Yeah.
And he's willing to do it. but it's still going to have that kind of practicality element. He's willing to take responsibility,
right?
You know, but he's really kind of done the work.
He has the language.
Yeah, but it looks like he's done the work. He's pretty solid. He's done all he can do. He can't live in the past or in shame anymore because he's recovered.
Right. Yeah, that's totally what it is. Yeah. He doesn't feel like this wake up every night guilty kind of thing.
Because he let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is part of it. Well, have you ever done the Al-Anon thing? Or?
When I was a kid, I would.
Yeah.
With my mom, I would. That was part of like
Palatine?
a mandated sort of thing that I would have to go and be a part of. But then I haven't really been that big of a part of that since I was a child.
How about that ACOA?
No, I haven't done any of that.
There's some good fucking, I hear there's some pretty solid ACOA shit going on. I know a couple cats who do that, you know, who are come from like the serious alcoholism families. And that's like a kind of emotionally grad level kind of shit.
That's cool.
Yeah, because it's a specific thing. I don't know. I mean, you know, it just like, it seems like contextualizing is the difficult thing. Like, you know, if you're going to therapy, right, and you're working out this stuff and you're trying to access the grief, I mean, it would seem to me that what you're experiencing is, you know, highly common for people who were brought up or who grew up in that shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And being part of some group mind around it would probably enable maybe some more access.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I should do stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe once a week or something.
once or four times a week.
Well, I'll tell you who I know.
Okay.
So now, how is this special being received, dude?
People have been nice on the internet. Tweeted people.
That in and of itself is really rare.
Yeah, people have been cool. I didn't know, but I do a Bill Hicks joke, so people have been really angry about that.
Which one?
About Jesus on the cross. And
that's right. That's a Lenny Bruce joke.
Oh, it's a Lenny. Well, people have been tweeting that it's
I know Bill did his version. Everyone does their version.
Okay. Cool.
Thank you.
Because people have been tagging you in all these posts. They go, Mark Maron, Whitmer Thomas steals Bill Hicks's joke.
They're telling me that you did it?
Yeah.
Oh,
and they tagged Joe Rogan, too. So that's been the most of the hatred.
Look, man, I did a thing. Like, I accidentally thought I did a Bill Hicks line on Conan many years ago, and it plagued me forever. But it turns out, like, a lot of people were doing that joke.
But
your joke is exactly what? What was it?
It's my aunt called me one year on my mom's death day.
Yeah.
Which is a weird day to remember somebody, but we're taught to remember things that way. When Jesus comes back, I feel like he'll be like, first order of business, let's remove all the memorabilia from the worst day of my life.
Yeah, right. It was certainly around when Lenny was around, but I get it. Yeah, so yeah, dealing with a little of that.
Dealing with that, but other than that, everybody online has been really cool. People have said nice things, and I didn't necessarily think that people would connect in the kind of way, you know. So many people have dealt with the same kind of shit,
right?
You know?
Right.
And so it's been cool and it's been nice, you know. People have been nice to me about
it. And it's getting you more work, or
I don't know yet, because right now we're stuck at home. But
I hope so. For a minute, yeah.
You know,
how long has the special been out?
Since late February.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope it does. You know, like I had to cancel a tour. But,
right, of course. Now, did it come along with, like, are you developing for HBO now?
No.
They just gave you the special?
No, yeah. How it happened is they saw this version that I was doing before I had music, and they were like, I'm not too interested in that. Then I was doing it with music. Bo Burnham saw that, and then A24 got involved, and then we pitched it to HBO, this idea. And like of me going home and kind of doing it there. And then they were like, cool, yeah, let's do that.
Uh-huh.
And they just kind of let me go. And then we had to hurry because the tourist season was about to end. So we needed people there to actually go to the show. So we had to shoot it like a month later.
So you shot that for outside of friends and family, which I guess was, what, a dozen?
Right.
You shot that for real fucking Gulf Shore tourists?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty brave. were you fucking, How'd you pull that off without fucking
They're
collapsing?
Cool, man. Me and Sean Patton used to do a show there like twice a year.
At that place?
Not there, at another place similar to that.
Yeah.
And they love it, man. And Sean would fucking demolish just like telling whatever stories. You know, they're just open.
He's a Southern boy too, right?
Yeah.
Where's he from? New Orleans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was like, they were cool.
Uh-huh.
They laughed more at a couple of jokes than anybody, like that Dumb in Love song I have. Yeah, yeah. They like at first thought that I was one of maybe more similar to them politically, and then they realize I'm making fun of them, and they're like, oh, that's funny too. You know, it was like, they were cool.
Okay.
At the end of the show, I was like, how many people's moms or dads died here? And like 95% of the crowd.
No. How's Sean doing?
Sean's great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I haven't seen him in a long time. I don't see a lot of the kids of your generation that often.
You know what's funny is when I first started doing comedy, you were around all the time. Like, or maybe right before too, I would see you at like all the weird shows. Maybe early. It was like right when WTF had started.
Yeah, because like I was still like, you know, I had to, like I hadn't, I needed to kind of like get some foothold. You know, I needed to work. And I think I was working at the store, but like, you know, I didn't want to do the improv. I didn't really want to do the Laugh Factory. And I felt like at that time, I thought it was necessary that I do those places for that audience. That was a missing piece.
Yeah.
Were those audiences. And that because I had been part of the original alt comedy movement in New York, that like I had some sort of place in it. But like I never liked the audiences that much. You know, it was just too selective.
Yeah.
You know, like I came up in clubs, you know, performing for a broad, you know, base of people. And then it's just like everybody was so precious and the comedy was so specific. And I always resented it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did it and people did like me and it was fine. They seemed to be like, here comes our cranky uncle. But I definitely had a sort of like resentment to the homogenization. Yeah. Of a type of comedy, because it was all the same.
Yeah.
Those audiences.
Yeah. I like going to the Comedy Store. I've tried many times to like get in at the Comedy Store and I just can't. It's like just going and hanging out all the time.
Well, now those audiences that were kind of built, you know, through alt comedy or through, well, it's weird because now there is sort of a new generation of, you know, actually excited comedy audiences. Like people have become, you know, because we're all sort of putting ourselves out there on platforms and because of podcasts, there's just a whole world of younger people that are like on top of it and know the dudes and are into the thing and they come out. You know, it's really kind of was before the plague, a kind of heyday for it all.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems like as that's happening, a lot of those alt spaces are kind of closing down or they're not as many, right?
No way. There's not nearly as many alt shows as there used to be. It used to be like you could do a show a night,
right?
You know, alt show a night, but now it's like, and also it used to be that the Comedy Store, nobody was there.
Oh no, yeah.
When I first started.
Ghost town. Yeah.
So what's, yeah, it's like, it's crazy how it kind of flipped around.
Right, right. And but a lot of the people that were driving the alt scene also became bigger acts.
Yeah.
And so they don't do it anymore.
Yeah, they all came famous. I was thinking about that the other day, or like maybe, you know, about 6 months ago. It's like, shit, nobody from my crew has gotten famous. It's like, who's it going to be? Because the guys ahead of us, there's like 10 of them who got super big. And then there's y'all's scene. Y'all got super big. And I'm like, fuck, we're already in our 30s and nobody.
Oh, dude,
so
I
far.
Was in my 40s.
Oh, yeah, that's good. That's a good reminder. It's also funny to think that I was seeing you.
No, I'm not of the next one up. Like, you know, I think, like, Zach, I would say, is probably the one after me.
Oh, really?
Kind of.
Okay.
Maybe not. I mean, like, I remember when Zach started, you know, and I don't believe we started at the same time.
Yeah.
I feel like he started a little after me. Like, Rogan's definitely in my generation.
Yeah.
All I know is the one on top of us was that 80s crew. You know, like Seinfeld and all those guys. And then, you know, we're the wave after that.
Yeah.
And then there's another wave and then you guys.
That's always the best thing. You know what is something that everybody, you always ask people from the store that they always skip right over that on your podcast?
What?
Is you'll go, what was it? What was that? You always go, what was that like about Jim Carrey?
Oh, yeah.
And they just go, I don't know. And then they talk about something else.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, why does everybody always skip over the Jim Carrey conversation?
I don't know. I feel like he wasn't around that much.
Yeah.
Like that. There were certain people that started there. But like, that's true. You know, like he doesn't get mentioned that much. You know, I don't know how long he stayed in it. I feel like, you know, it was kind of like meteoric.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when he locked in. But I don't, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I wish he would come on.
Yeah, it's weird he hasn't.
Well, I don't know. He's sort of an isolated dude. He's an odd dude.
Yeah, he's a strange guy.
Yeah, you know, but he's a very manic, very creative guy. But I don't know, as more podcasts sort of exponentially grow, I think that the kind of like the idea that they need to do this one kind of gets a little diminished when there's so many other ones. Like, I know I'm sort of that second wave OG. I didn't invent the podcast, but I helped popularize it. But now we're at some other level, man. Like, you know, there are certain people that are like, you know, they have a choice.
Right.
You know, all I can offer, like someone like Jim Carrey is like, well, I talked to Tom Dreesen and J.J. Walker. So
yeah.
If you want to be part of my little oral history experiment around the Comedy Store, you can come down and do that.
No, you talked to Obama.
Sure, yeah.
I think might know that guy.
Sure. No. I know. I'm just saying that, like,
right.
You know, whether they do this or Dax or if they're of a certain type of mind, they're going to do Joe, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I run the same shop over here. Hopefully we'll be able to continue doing live ones. It's hard to say. You're the last live one I've got booked.
Whoa, really? This thing is really working out for me, this corona.
Oh, yeah, man. I got to make some calls. She was willing.
Yeah.
But I guess we really don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, podcast is okay. I guess people want to make more cartoons now. There's some indoor stuff that are okay.
Oh, no, this is going to be the big, everyone's getting a whole new skill set. People never have to leave.
There's going
to
be some cool albums or some terrible albums.
I think that might be true.
Yeah.
Like, depending on how creative people are using their time.
Yeah.
Like, as far, I'm you know, occasionally getting on the live Instagram.
Yeah.
And then but I'm 10 minutes in, I'm like, this is stupid. There's nothing happening. I mean, you know, I'm out here in the garage again.
But people love it.
They do kind of. I wonder when people are going to start slipping, though. Kind of like, I'm back. Are you guys okay? I'm losing it.
We're just filming stuff they definitely shouldn't be filming.
Oh, that'd be great.
I think that already happened. An NBA guy accidentally filmed himself getting a blowjob on Instagram Live.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you accidentally?
I mean, I don't know. He said he was hacked, too, but it's like his hand on the...
Well, it's definitely something people are doing if they can.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So have you talked to your aunt?
Yeah, I talked to her a lot.
Oh, good.
She's never going to hear this, but hopefully we'll surprise her with the record that they wanted to put out. Getting it all mixed and mastered. And
that'd be sweet.
Get a label to put it out, some little reissue label, you know?
Sure, man. Press 500 or something.
Yeah. That's the dream.
Well, that's nice. And maybe then everything, you'll be all better.
I don't think so.
Thanks for talking, man.
Thanks, dude.
There you go. Quite a story. Yes? Watch the special, Whitmer Thomas, The Golden One, available on all HBO platforms, and also the songs from The Golden One, if you dig them, are available to stream or download. And as a CD or an LP with two exclusive tracks not featured on the special. But that was I like that guy. Nice guy. The guitar you're about to hear, I played live for an audience of about 3,000 people on Instagram Live. You're going to witness a very short, kind of clunky concert. But you only hear my part of it. We'll be right back. Boomer lives. Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.